Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. We are back with the Personal Wealth Coach. Thanks for staying with us through the break, through the news. Or, if you just picked up, thanks for doing that, too. If you're not listening, then you can't hear me saying no thanks to you. I have a great deal of goodies to talk about this hour. Going to start with some of the interesting facts about unemployment. So, duration of unemployment is how we measure how long people have been on the rolls of the unemployment. Now, you have to recognize that it's not the same people this year that have been unemployed as it was the people last year, although there are a very tiny few that are still on the list. So the Labor Department measures that with a period, sets a period. So there's less than 5 weeks of unemployment, 5 to 14 weeks of unemployment, 15 to 26, and then 27 weeks and more. The 27 weeks and more group, in August of last year, August of 2017, we had about 1.7 million people, 1.74 million people on the 27 week or more unemployment rolls. We now have 1.48 million on it. So we have cut into that drastically. This is more good news about the economy. Our 1.34, I'm sorry, I was reading the July number. So went from 1.7 to 1.3. 400,000 less people on the long-term unemployment, 27 weeks and over rolls. However, there's another group that we like to watch. One moment. Persons not in the labor force who want a job. That's a number that is a fascinating number here, because when we're still adding jobs at the 200 plus thousand a month level, where are those jobs coming from? We're at 3.9% unemployment. We're still at 3.9% unemployment. This is multiple months in a row. Well, we're hiring a couple of hundred thousand here, a couple of hundred thousand there. Where are those people coming from? So we're digging into it. Some of that is new population. We're having babies. They're growing up. They're getting jobs eventually. Okay, that's cool. Who's currently looking for a job? How many people are doing it now in the labor force? People that are not getting unemployment. They're not showing up at the unemployment officers. They're not going to the Texas Workforce Commission. They're not standing in line waiting for jobs. They want a job, but they're for whatever reason, it doesn't go into that, not actively looking. And last year in August, we had about 5.8 million people in that category. And this year in August, we have 5.5 million people. So this is different than the percentages. I like to dig into the actual numbers because the percentages become meaningless over time. What is 3.9% of what? How many people is that? Well, when we're looking at people that are not in the labor force, that want to be in the labor force, 5.8 million to 5.5 million, 300,000 more have come in from there. Well, that's cool. Who are these people? So who these people are is a very interesting conundrum. Economists are scratching their heads and they're trying to fill in the blanks. I'm going to tell you really simply, the opioid epidemic has a big part of this. When last year we had overdose deaths of 42,000 people. That's overdoses. That means that there's a lot more than the people that are overdosing that are using them. There is not a good number out there. We do not have any numbers on the people that are long-term on prescription opioids that have been there for long periods of time. So it's not like a statistic where I can go to the Labor Department and say, who are these people? CNN does numbers, Fox does numbers. They all kind of run into problems. So the latest surveys show that about 11.5 million Americans in 2016 misused opioids, prescription opioids. 11.5 million people were misusing them. We've got 5.5 million people that want to be in the labor force but have stopped working. You have to think that there is a component of overlap here. We have a crisis. We are out of jobs. We don't have enough, or we're not out of jobs. We're out of people to fill the jobs. We've got people that want to grow their businesses, and they're not going to hire people that are hooked on drugs. And these aren't the nasty, filthy drugs of the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. These are doctor-prescribed. These have the feeling of being correct, but we still can't hire them. You can't hire a forklift operator that's on opioids. If they had back issues, you can't hire a truck driver who's got knee issues and is on opioids. You're not supposed to operate heavy machines. If the company hires a driver to do that and they're on opioids, the liability issue goes through the roof. You can't hire these people. And yet we're not doing anything drastic about it. What could we do about it? Well, there have been some mentions by the Trump administration, prior to that by the Obama administration, but we're not seeing actual things happen. We've got gridlock over scandals. The nature of daily life in Washington, D.C. is not about solving problems. It's about throwing mud. We got some real issues with that. I'm going to tell you another one that is right up on the top of my list. It's been a year, a full year, since Equifax came out and said, hey, we were hacked. Not only hacked, we were hacked so many times. We don't know how many times we were hacked. We were hacked by a lot of people. We don't know how many. All of this information that we've been storing, all the personal information that we've been storing on American citizens, it's we don't know how much of that we lost. Social security numbers, dates of birth, how many cars you own, what types of cars you own, what's the value of your house, what's the value of your mortgage. All that stuff is out there now. And a year ago, there was a huge uproar on the part of the United States Senate, the United States House of Representatives, by the Trump administration, by consumer groups, by Better Business Bureau. So come forward a year. What has happened after all of those promises by the president and by the Speaker of the House and by the Majority Leader of the House and by their Democratic counterparts? It's not all Republicans. Everybody got together and said this was a bad thing. We got to do something about it. So what's happened? Well, the two bills that were introduced in the Senate never saw a vote. They just disappeared. That's a problem, guys, gals. We have a real problem here. There is a reasonable approach to this. Now, what have we gotten out of it overall? Well, it's free now to call up your credit monitoring services and say, put a lock on my stuff. Don't let people see what I have. Don't let them offer me free offers for credit cards. If somebody applies for a loan, I've got to have a signature, a call in for them to approve it. That makes sense. That's free now. It used to be expensive. It's not expensive anymore. That was not done by the government. That was a voluntary move on the part of the credit monitoring services. Well, I certainly think that we have a problem and that the American public's attention is wrapped up on the day-to-day scandal rather than the actual things that we need to fix to move forward. And I've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, you just stole my thunder in the last sentence. I was just going to inform you that you're all worried about the hacking of Equifax and all the information and stuff, and you're not worried about the fact that Donald Trump said good morning to the to a crossing guard last week or last year or whatever it was.
Or the scandal that the school crossing guard may or may not have had gum on their shoe at the time. I don't care.
Yeah, what difference that makes. So, you know, your point is a very good point. When are we going to start getting concerned about serious matters instead of this witch hunt or whatever you want to call it on Donald Trump?
Well, I've got an answer to that as well. I cannot blame the media, nor can I blame the president for being wrapped up in this. There's an old saying that any publicity is good publicity, and Donald Trump is a true believer in that. And another old saying is that follow the money. Newspapers, 24-hour news organizations get paid by advertisers. They get paid more money by advertisers when they have more people, eyeballs on the scene, whether that's newspapers, online, television, doesn't matter. Eyeballs is what they get paid for. And scandals bring eyeballs. Talking about a complicated set of hacks on an institution doesn't bring eyeballs. It's scary. That should do it. But there's so many other big scary things to talk about that we're losing sight of the things that we do have control over.
Well, and we don't realize that some of the news media, not all of them, but the New York Times, I think, would they would participate in destroying the nation we live in if they can sell 10 more newspapers.
I wouldn't you call know, it 10. I would say they would have to sell millions more. When it comes to a popularity contest, this is a big thing in journalism. Should we publish it is the question they ask themselves. And the first question they ask after that is it newsworthy? What does that mean? Is it newsworthy? What that means is, are people going to be interested in it? Not, is it good for the country? That doesn't come into the list. It's not in there. They're a for-profit institution. And as much as it's called the failing New York Times, this is one of those wonderful pieces of irony. I think it's fantastic. When Bill Clinton was president, it made Rush Limbaugh wealthy, hugely wealthy, because his ratings went through the roof because he was talking about a sitting president. When you have a Republican in the White House, conservative talk show programs' ratings go down. Gun sales go down. So all of the Republican concepts of what we're doing or what is being done in the world, gun sales, Republican commentary or conservative commentary, when people feel satisfied that it's not threatened, they're not going to pay attention. So if Rush Limbaugh makes a fortune because Bill Clinton is president and then his ratings dropped during the entire Bush administration, he had some spikes in there, but it was on average much lower than during Clinton, and then jumps back up when Obama's president, it shouldn't surprise us at all that while Bush was president, the New York Times' readership was up. Obama became president, the New York Times had its readership drop, which causes less revenue. This is where the term the failing New York Times comes in. Well, since the President Trump has been in office, the same thing has happened to the New York Times as happened to Rush Limbaugh. Their readership at the New York Times is going up drastically. They're, you know, pay raises for the editorial staff. They're paying more to their journalists. They have more journalists on staff. They're writing more stories, and it's because they have consciously taken an approach that definitely has a liberal bias. They also have other biases, and they'll throw out there to make sure people continue to read them that don't have a liberal bias. They'll throw out some conservative commentary every once in a while. But, you know, that's the same thing that Fox News does, only on the other side.
But should we consumers ask the logical question, if they can't find a front page story to put on the front of the New York Times and sell more newspapers, will they resort to just making one up and calling it anonymous?
If they make it up and they can't stand behind it, if they, you know, because at some point that anonymous op-ed writer's name is going to come out, just like Deep Throat's name came out. At some point, the anonymous becomes non-anonymous. And if we see the scandal at the level of they made it up, it will cause the New York Times to fail. Because credibility is the coin of the media. If people stop trusting them, then people stop buying them. Otherwise, I mean, that's not true across all media. If you buy the National Enquirer, hopefully most people don't trust that Elvis had a secret baby who's part bat. You know, that's a normal thing to be on the Enquirer, but you know what you're getting when you're buying an Enquirer. If you're looking for good news, like, for instance, I read the New York Times. I read the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, The Economist, The Washington Post, and Bloomberg, and the list continues on and on and on and on and on. And the reason why I read so much is because by reading all of them, I find the truth in the averages. I find the truth that is biased. Everybody's got a bias, and you got to recognize what the bias is. I have a bias. You have a bias. We all have biases. Biases can be really good. I have a bias against crossing the street without looking both ways. If you know that about me, you know that I don't have problems walking. Every time I come to a street, I stumble to a stop. No, I'm doing that on purpose. You understand my bias. A bias...
Do you really think that I might have a bias? me?
You? I can't imagine it. Con, if you have a bias, you know... We're all biased.
We're right here on your show. I'll go ahead and plead guilty.
If we cannot all agree that we're all biased, then the conversation really can't go on. Finding what we're biased about. If you don't know what you're biased about, you got to find it, because that can affect your entire life. If you're biased in a way that didn't have your conscious approval for the bias, that's a problem. Hopefully, all of your biases are things that you've chosen.
Everybody ought to examine themselves and say, you know, I am biased against lying newspapers or whatever it might be.
Right, or examine that lying say, politicians, lying journalists, yeah.
Yeah, am I justified in my bias? And I think that I am, and that's why I plead guilty to it, and I'm not ashamed of it.
Right.
And you're not either.
Correct.
You know?
Now, I will immediately get ashamed of a bias. If somebody points out a bias that I have that I didn't know that I had, that was affecting my decisions and it wasn't something that I consciously put in place, I should be ashamed of that. If I have a bias about race that's not based on reality, that's a problem. If I have a bias against a political party or news organization in general or the president, that isn't based in choices that I made to say that's a good bias to have, that's a problem.
Well,
and let me just one more thing, a good bias. You know, racial profiling is a bias. If you're in a bad part of town and you see people that are of a different race than you in that bad part of town, it's really easy to apply the bias of I've got to be careful because I'm in a bad part of town to the rest of your day-to-day living. Not in a bad part of town now and see the same race, you shouldn't apply the same bias. You should apply a different one, whatever that is.
But if you have a bias about a particular group and you know that they just killed 47 people yesterday because of a skin color, then I could justify that bias.
As long as you can justify it, number one, and then when you relook at it in an unemotional setting. So if somebody's killed 42 people, and I don't know that you, was that an actual event or is that there's just a...
No, I'm figuratively speaking. I'm just making it a case.
Okay, if somebody's killed 42 people and you apply a bias against someone who did not kill 42 people, but might be loosely connected through complete circumstantial coincidence, then that's a bad move. If you look at, here's a good bias. ISIS, bad. I don't like ISIS. If they killed 42 people and a guy walks down the street waving the ISIS flag, I think it's a completely rational and good use of a bias to say, I'm staying away from that guy. I think this guy needs to be looked at. He's a danger. But if you find somebody who's just happens to pray the same way or happens to have the same haircut or whatever it is, that is something we find patterns, and you might get a gut reaction that's based on fear that you've done before. It's a new bias. You should make sure that your biases are appropriate. That's important.
I had a lady tell me one time that she thought I was opinionated.
What?
And my answer to that
3 minutes, stations. 3 minutes to your next Fox News 30/30.
Sorry about that.
You know, I said to her, I wouldn't give a nickel for somebody that doesn't have an opinion.
Right.
If you don't have an opinion, what are you? You're just a vacuum.
Yeah.
So I plead guilty to being opinionated.
So,
you know, and if you don't like it, well, don't listen to me.
Right. Going back to the news media versus politicians, the first thing we've got to recognize there is that there are real biases held by politicians and by journalists. They are worth listening to as long as you are aware of the bias. If you agree or disagree with the bias, it's irrelevant. Just be aware of it. If you're a fan of the president, if you're a fan of the former president, and you think that anything that they say is correct because they said it, that's a bad bias.
Yeah, but there are good ones and there's bad ones, and I know a guy that's kind of got to get off of here and go prepare for a
call. All right.
Show.
Thanks, Con. That double voice that you just heard is Con was on the phone in the doorway, so the microphones were picking him up as well as the phones. Thanks for the call, Con.
You're welcome.
And he called "You're welcome" down the hallway if you couldn't hear it. So Equifax, haven't touched it. The law hasn't changed. The security from the perspective of law enforcement has not changed. And that's a problem. That's a massive problem. We're at the days in the United States that are very similar to the 1860s through the 1890s, where private police forces are the way that we pursue lawbreakers. The Pinkertons were called up to find the James Gang and a whole series of other outlaws that were at large because we didn't have a governmental institution to do it. And we're doing a version of that now to find hackers. And that's a problem. So we got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, you know, I hate to do this to you, but I heard you earlier talk about that Rush Limbaugh became fabulously wealthy because of Bill Clinton.
I said his ratings went way up and it improved his fortune in a fabulous way. That is correct.
That may be partially true, but when I first, I was a long-haired, dope-smoking FM type. You know, that's what Rush calls people like I was back in when George H.W. Bush was in office.
Read my lips.
And,
yeah.
And one day I was borrowing my dad's truck because my my car was in the shop and I had to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
So I stuck in an 8-track tape or something. I forget what we had, a cassette tape or something. And
may have been a little late for 8-tracks, but you might have had one.
Yeah, it might have been. But anyway, I listened to some rock music on the way to college and parked the car and took out the tape, and the radio was on an AM station, and I heard this this guy say, "Now back to the best of Rush." And
right.
I'm like, oh, wow, they're going to play 2112 or something.
Going to get some falsetto out of this.
And anyway,
Ron Rush.
I heard this guy talking to an African American person, and they had a conversation together.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fascinated. I could not believe what I was hearing, and I was hooked ever since. And to make matters worse, when I was at work one day, I fell off a ladder and fractured my elbow, so I was on workman's comp for a good 2 or 3 months.
Ouch.
And I started listening to this Rush guy, and I just got hooked on talk radio. And you know, sure, when Clinton got in office, he became a lot more entertaining. I mean, I have to admit.
Right. And his ratings went way, way up. He still had ratings. He was still definitely making a living. He had private jets during George H.W. Bush. It's not like he was destitute. But Clinton definitely gave him a couple of extra jets.
Yeah, and he also created a whole bunch of other people's careers.
Yeah, that's true. And when I say that, I'm saying it because the irony is there. People's attention is much more focused when they feel unheard and unlistened to. So the liberals right now feel unheard and unlistened to, which is why their focus is so strong. This is why the readership of the New York Times is way up. They are massively profitable right now. The Washington Post is massively profitable right now, where if you just go back a few years, the death of the newspaper was the headline. And you know, the old gray lady was slowly faltering down. People were being laid off. Editorial staff was being cut back. So this is one of the things that I think the president should talk about in his stumps when he's talking about the strength of the economy, when he's talking about unemployment. He should claim credit for the rise in the fortunes of the New York Times. I think that would be hilarious.
Hey, you know, now that you mention it, when Air America started, and I want to talk about something financial before I hang up, but anyway, when Air America started, I was fascinated by that, too. And I listened to it, and...
Oh, you mean the liberal channel, not the CIA effort to supply drugs to Asia?
Yeah. I'm talking about that liberal channel where they had Al Franken and all these people. I thought that was very entertaining.
I agree.
I guess it was just not... I guess they just didn't quite find a niche or something. I'm not exactly sure.
They were a lot more acidic. It was hard to sit and listen for a long period of time without just feeling like they were angry at everyone.
There's
a lot of angry conservative commentary, but they're much more relaxed about it. I think that's better for ratings.
Although I'm afraid that Alex Jones is going to have an aneurysm one of these days.
I agree.
But anyway, here's my financial question, sort of. Have you ever heard of a guy named... Markowski, he called himself the watchdog on Wall Street.
Markowski.
He's a New Yorker. He talks about financial stuff and he's very entertaining. Let me see if I can.
Watchdog on Wall Street. I pulled it up here. Markowski.
Yes.
I have not heard from him, but go ahead and ask the question anyway.
Well, I mean, he just talks about, he sort of reminds me of you a little bit, but he's a little more blunt, you might say, about people who rip people off.
Yeah.
These brokers, things like that. He likes to talk about how to get financially independent, and he made me kick myself because I worked at a place for a good 15 years, and I didn't think I was going to work there that long because I hated the place, and they offered me a 401k plan where they would match whatever I put in it, and I didn't do it because I didn't think I was going to work there that long. I ended up being there 50. And let this be a lesson to all of you listeners out there. I kicked myself after hearing Markowski because he said, I gave up free money.
Yeah. And while we don't give investment advice on the air, there are some very general practices that you, if you apply to yourself. Number one, if free money is available, do everything in your power that you can, barring hurting yourself, to get it. If a company is going to give you money for doing something, and it's not a lot of effort on your part, you should do it. And in the part of if they're matching your contribution to a 401k, max out that match. Even if it cuts into your income a bit, the long term of that is if they're matching you dollar for dollar, you've got an immediate 100% return there. There's no place else in the market that's going to guarantee you a 100% return because you can't. They are coming up with money out of their pocket as an incentive to you, but if you don't use it, they don't give it to you. So totally agree with what you're saying there.
Hey, I enjoy your show, and I listen just about every Saturday, and thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
Bye.
I'm not sure what it says about your sanity that you enjoy this particular program, but at least we're the same kind of insane. I've got some commercials to play. I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. The phone number in here is 254-773-1400. I'll be back on the other side of these commercials. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Steve. Yes, sir. And I have a question for you.
Okay.
What is the difference between a fixed annuity and a variable annuity, and which is the better one for the long term through economic downturn and upturn? I'll listen.
Okay. Thanks for the call. All right. This is a little bit of a long answer. Not a crazy long answer. Annuities in general. So before we say difference between fixed and variable annuities, before we get into the nitty-gritty, first off, and what is an annuity? An annuity is any payment that happens annually. Okay, that's not a good enough definition. Annuities as we know them today, and that's where the annua in annuity comes from, is annual. An annuity is how pensions were formed. It's how in Renaissance times when the head of a household would pay an allowance to the people in their family, they would pay it out annually. This is why in the movies about old times, when you hear the British talking to each other and they're matchmaking or whatever, and they say to each other, she's worth £40 a year. That's her annuity, her stipend, her pension. Those are all words that meant the same thing for a while. Coming forward, annuity, as the concept that we know it today, grew out of that through insurance. Annuities are offered through life insurance companies. And they are, in order to understand the annuity, you've got to understand life insurance first. Okay, that seems a little weird because they're different animals. They're not the same. But if you imagine a two-armed balance, kind of like justice is holding up as a statue, you've got a pendulum between the two. On the balance books for a life insurance company, annuities are on one side of the balance, and life insurance is on the other side of the balance. On the life insurance side, life insurance companies, you got to look at what is their profit model and how do they maintain. So obviously insurance happens at a loss. If somebody dies and they have insurance, according to the policy, if none of the rules are broken, then the insurance company is supposed to pay out a check to the family, the beneficiaries of this person. Money comes out. Well, how does an insurance company make a living doing that? If you're paying $1,000 a year for $1 million of coverage, How in the world do they make a profit charging $1,000 a year for somebody in their late 30s for $1 million of coverage? Well, it's about risks. What is the likelihood of somebody in their upper 30s dying during the period that they have the life insurance? And they look at numbers for that. The actuarial tables are done. Actuaries sit down and look at it. There's computers that crunch the numbers, and they say, how likely is someone in this age bracket, in this health bracket, to die in this given period of time? And they set their profitability based on it. The majority of people that own life insurance do not own it at the time of their death. That is another factor in profitability for life insurance companies. They've canceled the life insurance at some point so that the insurance company never has to pay out that full amount. Is it important to have insurance? Yes, it is. If you have known expenses that need to be taken care of in the event of a loss, whether from a fire or a death or whatever, and you don't have the assets to cover it, you need to get insurance. That's pretty basic. Okay. So what are the risks to the insurance company on that end? The risk is that you're going to die before they expected you to, and that a lot of people that are their customers are going to die before they expected them to, so that they've got this big chunk of money that they've got to pay out. How do they avoid that risk? One thing they can do is they can get insurance from other insurance companies. That's called co-insurance. That's one of the things they do to prop that up. Okay. Another thing they do is the other end of the balance sheet, the annuity side. With the annuities, there's a lot of ways to have annuities. We're going to begin with this concept of fixed annuity. If you have a single pay, begin immediately annuity, that's the same as like a lottery winning. When they say they're going to pay you every month for 20 years, a certain amount of money. You have a deposit, a certain amount of money goes into deposit, and they pay you money based on the money that you have on deposit. Now, once you've accepted that annuity from the lottery or from anywhere else, you say, all right, I'm getting my monthly money. Now I just want the lump sum. Give me the money that you have that you're holding there. The answer to that, unless you have a very specific type of annuity, is that money doesn't belong to you. That belongs to the insurance company now. They now hold the asset, that large lump sum. They are able to invest that asset any way that they see fit within the law to make a profit on that, so that they're hoping that the return that they receive on their investment of that annuity is enough to pay you and for when you die for them to retain the rest of it. So an annuity, if you die early, they get to keep the money. Now, there's different ways of approaching a fixed annuity. You can say, I want to make sure that my heirs at least get paid for 10 years. Or somebody gets paid for 10 years if I'm going to give you this lump sum. That's called a 10-year certain. There's a whole bunch of different options that go on annuities that say that the insurance company is required to pay a certain amount over a certain period of time. If you look at the numbers that they quote you on that, what you'll see is you pay more for those different guarantees. So if you're going to say during your lifetime you'll receive $1,000, if you put a 10-year certain on that, that may lower the amount of money that you'll receive, well, $1,000 a month. That'll lower the amount of money you receive by a certain amount. It might be $100 less. It might be $50 less. You have to look at each quote on the annuity for that. If you say, I want to make sure that somebody gets paid in my family or related to me in some way for 10 years on this, so I'm going to do a 10-year certain, well, you're going to get less of a monthly payment. Okay. What is a variable annuity? A variable annuity is no longer only an insurance company. Well, it's still only it's no longer just an insurance product. It's actually moved into equities now. There are market investments internal to it. The same is true for a variable life insurance. that the variable side of it is very much the same. And there's a, hold on to what we've got so far. Hold on to variability for just a moment. If you think about the old pension funds where you worked at IBM or General Motors and money was put from your paycheck into this pot with everybody else for a long time, and then you received an income off of that that didn't go up and down. That income was supposed to be guaranteed every month. That was called a defined benefit. You're putting money in. You don't know how much over time you're going to be putting in there, but you know how much you're going to get out. That's the defined benefit. When you know what you're putting in, but you don't know what's coming out of it, that's a defined contribution. So if you have a 401k, you know what you're putting in there every month. You know what your employer is putting in there every month. But you don't know what's going to come out of it in the future. Defined contribution, like a 401k, is variable for what you receive on the other end. And that's where the word variable comes from for variable life or variable annuities. What you put in is a fixed amount. What you take out is variable. And the fixed amount is because when you put it in, you knew what it was. When you pull it out, it could be different every month depending on what you decide. Unless you annuitize, then it becomes a fixed annuity. That's a different subject. So variable annuities are involved in the market. The question then was, what's better long-term, a fixed annuity or a variable annuity? And that's very much like saying, what's better long-term, a pickup truck or a van? It depends on what you want to use it for, number one. And number two, depends greatly on how old the van is, how old the truck is, who made them, what's the quality, and how much you're paying for them. So if you go to a used car dealership that is kind of shady and you say, what's better, this one or that one? The first one is to say, well, maybe neither of them because the price might be too high. So you got to do market research at the beginning to say, all right, all else being equal, is this a fair price? And you got to recognize that the price component, you can go online and get life insurance for less money than going to an agent. Some people still want to go with the agent because they can call that agent and ask questions and figure out what's going on. Other people say, I'm fine doing it online. I don't want the commission to be paid out. It'll make my purchase cheaper. The same's true with a